Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And if this is your first episode joining us in our podcast, welcome. We really appreciate you tuning in or hitting the button or whatever your player of choice is and listening in with us. And for those that have been with us for some time, welcome back. We appreciate you listening into our show. You know, Kirk, we've talked recently a couple different times about a range of topics, and I'm going to go back to some of our very early topics. I think our very first couple times we recorded in the Speaking of Reliability, we were talking about HALT testing. Now, one of the things that came up recently, I have two situations. One was a company that had, they're refreshing their product line. They've got I don't think it was a cost reduction, but they wanted to add some features to their next product. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, what do you know about your previous one? So that's one. And they kind of looked at me strangely. And then the second group is actually a startup that some of the engineers, many of the engineers, have previous product knowledge, but not on that particular product. And so they struggled with how do I use a different product here kind of knowledge. And I thought they were both pretty similar. Have you run into much of that, of, you know, people not really grappling with what they know about previous products?
Well, you know, Fred, it's one of the difficult things, and I've written about that, and the difficulty in getting past reliability issues and knowledge from, you know, failure analysis of maybe a couple years ago or when the product's been introduced way back, what testing was done and what records were kept in troubleshooting and finding the issues. So much of that, especially for companies that have a predecessor product, the difficulty in finding that is deters a lot of engineers from digging into it. You know, there's all kinds of obstacles in getting to accessing that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's legal. Sometimes, you know, it became a lawsuit or something like that.
Let's hope it's not that big of a problem.
Yeah, it's not, right. It's not that big a problem. But it was like when I was with a large company that made mass produced electronics, and it was so, you know, a mistake in manufacturing or in the design. Many times would become a lawsuit from the customer.
Well, yeah, it's deep pockets types of things.
Deep pockets, right.
Yeah, but the issue is that you're talking about stuff. I mean, the finance guys have the data. The lawyers for the big issues have the data.
Yeah,
but they have how many failed, but they don't. I think it breaks down very commonly when you're talking about it's difficult to get. It's difficult to get useful data. Right. The operations manager or whoever somewhere in the organization going, hey, we're paying too much for a warranty. Go fix it. And we're like, we'll fix what? I need failures. Right. You're throwing away or fixing everything and you're not doing failure analysis. What do I fix?
Right. Well, we're sending all the parts back to our suppliers and they come back with, you know, electrical overstress.
Yeah, there's what? We should do an article. We should do a whole episode on the five standard answers from suppliers.
Right, yeah. C&D, cannot duplicate, it works fine, you know.
Well, we knew about the problem and we fixed it. That's my favorite. We didn't tell you, but we knew about it and we already fixed it.
That's right. Or it's a small change. We didn't think it would affect you.
Yeah, that's right. There's all five. Yeah.
It was a cost reduction effort. And, you know, we saw
sometimes it goes wrong. Oh, well.
It worked to spec. But this is the challenge that any reliability engineer has, I think, if coming into a company, if they haven't been with them. And as we know, this industry, it changes so rapidly. I mean, one of the companies I worked with not 2 years ago in the area is gone. Everybody that was working on, you know, they're scattered to another company and they're going to.
Well, there's I think that's a whole nother barrier, though, right, Kirk, is that when you move to a new company, in both companies have you sign an NDA. And when we see it all the time as consultants, we're signing NDAs. As a part of employment, you sign one of those.
Right.
And so while you learn about, oh, yeah, this is this kind of damage or this kind of connector can be cold or this, you know, a proud high mass component's going to break its leads or screws back out. We learn generic stuff all the time. And that still applies to other places.
Yeah. Right.
But when somebody says, well, how often does that occur? Is it work in this design with this style of screw with this torque? We don't have that hard data a lot of times. Or a couple of days ago, I ran into a component that was a voltage overstress component. And I wanted to put it in a circuit to protect it from spikes and sags and stuff like that.
Right.
And I said, well, how often do you expect to see these things? So I had we had to dig into, well, how is it used and how often would you expect that phenomena? But because the component itself, every time it takes a hit, degrades a little bit. It chips away at it.
It uses up a little of its life. It does.
And so if by design you're going to see a pile of these things, well, then an MOV component is not the right component. We need something else.
Right.
And it's that experience, though, that I brought to the table going, you know, I've seen these before. I can't tell you where or when. I can't tell you. Let's go to the data sheet. Let's go to the vendor and get other info to deal with it. But realize that there are components that you do need to check. You need to be like ceramic capacitors. They crack. You can't just bang away at these things. You got to fix them. So we do carry in knowledge, and engineers in design groups often learn that stuff. What I think happens, though, is that you talked about legal and it's we do a good job on warranty, which is customer focusing, and somebody has to pay that bill and replace the product or, you know, do whatever.
Right.
But it breaks down when it goes to, well, what exactly failed, right? We lose it where it goes into failure analysis. And I think that's a huge barrier to allow us to learn from the previous product.
Right. Or there is no failure analysis. It's just replacement because it's, you know, it's easier to do. And failure analysis always adds another level of expense. I mean, especially if it's done well or you're decapsulating components or you're going into go back and do some testing that you should have done in the beginning, it can cost you a lot. And,
well, it can. Yeah.
And sometimes
how do you know what to fix, right? How do you know what to fix if you don't do that? So I think it's a false economy. Yeah, it's going to cost us some money to sort this out, but if you don't do it, you're just guessing.
Exactly, you're still fighting the fires instead of preventing them. And
that's right.
I know there's always more glory in being the hero that, you know, comes up with a solution than being the guy that, you know, says, let's put in smoke detectors and not have the building burn or not have the firemen show up and out the fire. Because that's pretty dramatic. And it is. You know, when I was with Storage Tech, a company that doesn't exist anymore, I remember how the field service guys got all the accolades and some of them. The head of it, you know, for solving the problem that they should have solved in the design phase.
Yeah, but they wouldn't talk to you during the design phase. And, you know, there is some barrier there.
And it also wasn't a problem in the field.
It wasn't really a problem. Yeah.
Until it got to the field. Yeah. And they realized it was a problem. And that's when they, you know, but going back and then showing them that you could have done this with stress or this, obviously, you know, things like you look at their records, like, oh, loose connectors, a thermal shutdown or a thermal issue.
Yeah, or
timing
issues. Cable wear.
Yeah. All would say, look, if you've done this, if we do this, I mean, it helps you build up the case for more aggressive testing and especially testing to limits, to empirical limits. Which
go find it, yeah. But so let's go back to Kirk, though, go back to, well, how do you actually, I mean, if the barrier is that products fail and we're not doing failure analysis, and in some cases, not even getting products back.
Right. It's cheap enough. It gets thrown away.
Right. There's a lot of value, though, in getting those units back. Even if they're throwaway, pay for the postage and get it shipped to you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some, but they don't recognize that. You know, it's hard to get them to recognize. It's so, maybe it's a kind of a you know, a disappointment. You know, when they hear about something in the field. Of course, they're looking for possible blame too. A lot of times, that's unfortunate. But you know, it's somebody's fault. And many times, technically, it is overlooked by somebody or a mistake in manufacturing.
Well, there's two levels of follow-up, I think. And this was, I learned this from a colleague when I was at HP. And it was, you know, there's the detail, what failed, what component failed, what solder joint failed, what, you know, cable was routed incorrectly, whatever. Let's get products back, even if it's just the initial ones, and we spend the extra money and get the talent to look at it and do the failure analysis and spend the money on there. And we didn't have much argument with our management at HP to do that, because they recognized the value of it. But we learned so much in the first 2 months that, and it was stuff that we should have gotten during production or during development. And it wasn't like we were slacking during development, but you still learn stuff when you go to production. And the other part that my colleague brought up is, well, we need to look back at the product life cycle. Where should we have caught this? What decisions did we make that limited the number of prototypes, or eliminated a handful of stress testing, or didn't verify this new vendor we added at the last minute, you know, or stuff like that. We would make mistakes and in the process. And it was looking at, it wasn't to blame somebody for making a bad decision, but why did we not have the right information to make a better decision? And we stress those two things a lot. Yeah, the failure analysis part, though, I've seen one organization that they did 100% of all failures went through failure analysis.
Okay.
You know, the poor techs were, you know, they get 50,000 units back and they're going through and taking them all apart and they're finding four different failure mechanisms.
Okay.
Over and over and over again. But they had great data. They knew exactly what the problem was.
Right. They had the four things that they could correct or find a way to correct.
Yeah.
It may not be easy. And it may take time, but, you know, it was so expensive for them to have that coming back. And after the first, you know, several hundred, I would think, they could easily have said, well, we pretty much see the dominant modes and mechanisms here that fail. Let's fix them. Yeah. Let's try and fix them. And maybe they were. And certainly I encourage, we encourage, I'm sure, it early in the product's life production cycle that you would start either screening, you know, doing some aggressive stress testing, or absolutely be calling each customer, depending on the complexity of the equipment or expensive equipment, and finding out if and when the performance, if the performance was the product was failing or not performing properly, we'd be quickly monitoring that. And that comes from beta. You know, a lot of customers were beta customers that the company send out, and they know that, you know.
Well, they set the expectation.
They set the expectations. They know this customer well, and the customer knows the company and what the history has been. So, you know, they're willing to take that risk in getting the newest maybe product out or, you know, into their facility and look at it, see if it can help them that much more.
Well, so. You mentioned earlier, though, that, and I've seen this also, is that even if you do a really good beta on your product launch and you pay attention to the product as it's launched and so on, if you're lucky, that information goes into a database or into a file cabinet somewhere.
And then,
you know, 3 months later, you know, somebody's hard disk or under their desk or the dog ate it or whatever. And then, you know, 6 months later, you're ramping up the next product and, or it's a new, relatively new crew that's brought in that's working on another project. And it just gets lost. It's that tribal knowledge goes away. And I think there's a barrier there also. It's just, how do you?
Well, I think also, as we've talked about, companies go and come and go and disappear. And there's a few like Hewlett Packard that have been around a while, but they've been split up several times, or different versions of them and branches and, you know, sub companies. But that's one of the problems we have in this industry, is there's a lot of in our industry, technology changes very rapidly, and that also has engineers changing companies fairly rapidly.
Come on, there's only so many ways that a connector fails, or a ceramic capacitor fails, or an electrolytic capacitor fails.
Well, sometimes that's not written down. That it goes, it's tribal knowledge.
Right.
And the tribe splits up.
And then we have, at one group I worked with, they were having a big argument over, they had some failure mechanism they were dealing with. Yeah. And they had six people in the room, and they had six different histories of what was the cause for it. And you don't need a meeting to solve this one. Go do an experiment, figure out which way it's failing, and go solve it. You can have opinions all day long. Let's go figure it out.
Right. Let's go see what's right and what's not, because physics doesn't lie.
Right.
Stress doesn't lie.
sometimes it's our combined experience and tribal knowledge and stuff. I mean, in some cases, it really does need to be written down, whether it's a design guideline or design guidance. Don't put this kind of capacitor in here because its technology is not suitable for it. It's moisture sensitive, and you're putting it in a warm, moist environment. It's not going to work.
Right.
Come on, common sense here, guys. But sometimes that's hard to find.
We hope that we know that, as we've talked about, engineers design away from failure. Mm-hmm. If they know something's going to fail, they generally don't put it in. Mm-hmm. And you hope that you don't have a lot of those situations that you have to explain that the environment, this component is not suitable. I mean, you do have the situation of, like we just talked about, downhole well logging instrumentation and things like that inherently have to go exceed beyond what they're designed to do, the components. They're usually, the semiconductors are standard and 125 rated to 125°C, but you do have to.
You're running at 200°C.
Yeah. And that's required. And nobody's going to, they don't make, I don't think, make chips that operate in those conditions.
Oh, gallium arsenide chips can do it. Can get to that. Right. Yeah. But you're right.
I've seen they use standard chips. I've seen the instrumentation in there, the drill bits and things like that. And they use standard chips, but they do some special things. But still, the silicon inside is the same silicon that's going to run at 50°C and many other products.
Well, that brings up one that, two things you just mentioned. Was one is people move from company to company, and companies change, and product technology changes and experience changes. One of the barriers to learning from a previous product is this notion of not invented here. Right.
Right.
That doesn't work here. We're special. We make a unique product that nobody else makes.
Absolutely. Every facility is that way.
Oh, it's amazing. When I was working at Raychem years and years ago, the chairman or the CEO created an award in the company, and it was called the Not Invented Here Award, the NIH Award. And it came with like $1,000 check.
Yeah.
And if you stole an idea from another division, and if you helped somebody steal an idea from to another division, you both got the award. And one of my techs solved a really major problem. We were really struggling with it. And he goes, the guy that lives next to me works in this other division. And it was his neighbor. And they were sitting over a barbecue. Their kids are playing. And he goes, we're having this problem. You guys do something similar. And he goes, we don't have that problem. Here, try this. And it completely solved the problem.
Uh-huh.
And it was, it's like, why are we struggling with these guys solved it 2 years ago?
I know.
But our engineers were all like, oh no, we use different stuff. We have a different program. Our extruder is north south and their extruder is east west. They couldn't possibly work here.
Right. So that's why I think conferences are so important. You get to share a lot of information. You maybe make it, sanitize it so that they don't know specifics, but you hear exactly, what the solution to, or maybe a better solution.
Or you learn about what to look for, or what symptoms mean. And it's amazing.
And again, it's so hard for us to share reliability information. We all sign NDAs. We can't really talk about, we're not supposed to, and we can't reference older companies and details that would help us in their, you know, new new clients' product. And, you know, we can just say, well, I can't show you pictures of it, but, you know, I can tell you from experience, this is true.
This are things to look for.
Yeah. And in fact, of course, I'm going to use your own information from your own systems to be able to produce a, you know, halt has talk that's going to be relevant with your own data, with your own failures, and will show that if you had used vibration or thermal limits, you would have found these issues.
Right. So, and it's, again, it goes back to internal looking at your own product that goes to your same customer, same market, you know, is your best source of this stuff. And you got to get the failure analysis, think about it, log it, record it, make it accessible, make it your engineering team's aware of those issues. That's invaluable, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. And especially when you talk about testing to limits, because that is the very hardest thing for most engineers that haven't been exposed to discovery testing to understand, is that, you know, there's very, very good, it's very relevant, and you can find failures that they could agree would have been found with testing to much higher levels of stress than they'd ever tested before. That's a great way to sell much more aggressive testing, which is what we are certainly
wrote a whole book about.
I write a whole book about. Let's forget about quantifying so much, because there are cases, and we do have that covered in the book, where you can have a three-tiered experiment, but those take a long time, and you may not get to the end before the product's released, or get to a failure mode. I mean, it's difficult. Right. Obviously, if you built a robust product or a good product, it may not fail for a long time, even in your qualification or long term testing. I mean, you hope so.
All right. Anyway. Well, let's wrap this one up. I think there's lots to be learned. You got to pay attention to it. So if you're listening in on this one, I'm quite sure, you know, Kirk, we've got so many different listeners and so many different industries and situations.
Oh, you guys all have experiences that you could share, and I wouldn't want to. And if you can, that'd be great. Or certainly questions to us about how you might approach a difficult problem of getting data.
That's right.
Failure data.
So head over to AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR, and there you'll find a couple different ways to get in touch with us. Primarily, just leave us a message, leave us a comment or a question, and join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. It provides ideas and tidbits and questions and direct material that we can use for future episodes. And so it's a great way for you to join the conversation. So let's see if we get any good stuff out of that, Kirk, and learn something, because we do know a lot combined, and we keep learning every day. So that'll all be good.
Yeah. And again, thanks everybody for listening. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.